So because you know that the antenna tuner has an output impedance of 50 ohms and capacitance of 150, it is identical to a 10.9 to 1 standing wave ratio also. And here's the problem. Because the antenna tuner output impedance is 10.9 standing wave ratio, 150 ohms minus J150, you would say also whatever reflected power hits the output end of the antenna tuner, 31% of it is going to go forward toward the transmitter, and 69% is going to be re-reflected toward the antenna. You would think that because it's a 10.9 standing wave ratio at that point. And of the 30% flowing forward, if it did flow through the antenna tuner toward the transmitter, then the bird watt meter on the input end of the antenna tuner would not see 50 watts forward and 0 watts reversed. 30% of the power being applied to the output end of the antenna tuner would be there. Let me drop quick. Antenna tuner is a 10.9 standing wave ratio. It does have, when it's tuned correctly, it only has to add this 150 ohms of capacitor reactance on the output end to make everything come out hunky-dory. Now here's the catch. The 30% of power that you think is going to flow, the reverse power, which happens to be 112.5 watts, you think 31% of that is going to flow into the antenna tuner and into the transmitter. But there's a catch. The transmitter is simultaneously generating 50 watts. You could call that a bucking voltage if you like. The bottom line is 0% goes forward. Every bit of it gets reflected. I haven't proven that last step yet. I know it happens. You and I have put our antenna tuner, we have put our bird watt meters at various ends of an antenna tuner. Let me drop it. We watch the antenna tuner do a perfect impedance match between a 50 ohm transmitter and a crazy antenna. We have seen the powers going in crazy ways on the output end of the antenna tuner. And the input end, we saw the exact right amount of forward power and nothing in reverse. So we know it obeys the laws of conservation of energy. We know the antenna tuner radiates none of the power. We know it dissipates none of the power. It runs ice cold. It applies none of it back to the transmitter. The only thing left is it's got to be re-reflecting it forward. I haven't proven that last step. There's something funny going on with the bucking voltage going on inside of the antenna tuner caused by the fact that the transmitter is sitting there continuously cranking out 50 watts. He's continuously cranking out 50 volts at 1 ampere, and somehow that gets added to the 75 volts of reflected, and that becomes 90 volts forward. Of course, those numbers don't add. Power-wise, they come out correctly. Voltage-adding-wise, they don't. That last step, I haven't yet figured out what's going on there. Damn, interesting question. And it had me pulling the hair quite a bit this week, because I forget about that double voltage phenomenon when you open circuit a transmission line. That's where we are so far, Steve. You've asked a very provocative question. Question John. You've asked a very provocative question, and we've only got 75% of the answer so far. W2VEH, I wonder if you run into some similar problems. K2RIW in the TechNet.
What's the phase relationship between what's coming out of the transmitter and what's coming back at it?
The transmitter sees a pure 50 ohm load, obvious by the fact that the bird watt meter on the input end of the antenna tuner, or the output end of the transmitter cord, it sees 50 watts flowing forward and 0 watts flowing reverse in this particular example. There ain't no phase angle there at that particular piece of cable. On the input end of the antenna tuner, there is no reflected power. Therefore, you can't talk about the phase angle of the reflected power. If you're now asking what is the phase angle of what goes into the antenna tuner versus what comes out of the antenna tuner, I suspect the answer is going to be 33.7 degrees, but I haven't proven that one yet. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, the reason why I ask is because I've built quite a number of buffing power supplies. The phase relationship that of the oscillator you're putting together and the way the coil is wound, it becomes important. So I was thinking is that let's consider the transmitter to be 0 degrees phase in this whole thing. And this 33% that's coming back to the antenna tuner, what's its relationship to what's being fed into the antenna tuner? Because you get a true 100% buffing, there has to be a specific relationship between the two of them. You would expect them to be exactly in 0 degrees phase, but delayed by one cycle or whatever the length of time that it takes to travel back to where it started from.
I think you're right, Eric, and I'm going to pursue it that way. Right now, there's a little bit of lack of good mathematical basis for how I know that all the reflective power hitting the output end of the antenna tuner, every bit of it gets re-reflected forward, and it becomes in phase with the power of the voltage that the transmitter is now creating. And they add the energy-wise, the 50 watts from the transmitter gets added to the 112.5 watts being reflected to the output end of the antenna tuner in this example, and the new forward voltage, 50 watts higher, is 162.5 watts. I know that happens, but the exact mechanism inside the antenna tuner, how a simple series capacitor, in this case, 150 ohm capacitor reactance, can do all that. All the antenna tuner in this case has to do is have a series, simple, 150 ohm capacitor. That's the simplest of all possible ways. I mean, if you did it with an L network, one of the components that you put in the L network is not required, if you know what I mean. Over to you for any comments on this one, Eric. K2EJ, wait for the beeps, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. No, I agree with you. When we talk about this stuff, when we talk about capacitive reactants or inductive reactants, we don't visualize, we don't think of it in terms of it being a storage device. The one thing that we haven't spoken about here is time, or how one cycle of a signal relates to that one cycle of the signal that you develop maybe X number of P's later. It would be interesting to have a storage scope, you know, or a signal analyzer, and you look at the turn-on characteristics of what's happening there. So that degree might give you a clue. But don't forget, when we go back into this mechanism of a capacitor, we've now done a little phase change. The fact that it's come back into it, we've delayed it a little bit, you know?
I agree. I'm going to add a couple words to this. The reason why you add a reactance, adding a reactance to an antenna, makes the standing wave ratio go up so high, is because you cannot continuously pour energy into a reactor, whether it be a capacitor or inductor. If it's a high-quality capacitor, high-quality inductor, which means it doesn't have a whole lot of series resistance, you cannot continuously pour power into it. On the first half cycle, you're charging the inductor or you're charging the capacitor. On the second half cycle, it gives every bit of that energy back. So in this particular case, where the antenna chosen by John is 150 ohms resistor and 50 ohm resistor, 150 ohm inductor, a hell of a lot of energy that you're applying to the antenna, the 158 volts, a lot of that energy goes into the inductor, but every bit of it comes back out 33.7 degrees later at the time delay. So the antenna is reflecting 69% of the power you put into it, and it's doing it with a 33.7 degree delay. That's the time delay of the energy going into that inductor and coming back out. And in the case of the capacitor you have on the output end of the... Let me drop it. The capacitor you've got in the output end of the antenna tuner, which now gives you a perfect impedance match, of the reflected power going into that capacitor, it's giving it back to you, again, exactly with 33.7 degrees phase angle, but in this case, it's leading phase, not lagging phase. So the leading phase of the antenna tuner output and the lagging phase of the antenna itself cancel, and therefore you get a pure 50 ohms in and out as far as the, a pure 50 ohm input impedance to the antenna tuner that's seen by the transmitter. So there you got a rough guess. Because the circuit is a little bit on the simple side, you can figure out the time delay. Ordinarily, an antenna tuner, which really is in many 20 cases of Pi Network. Let me drop it. The Pi Network has a certain amount of Q to it, and therefore there is a certain amount of transfer delay. If the energy you're putting into a Pi Network, what comes out, in general, is 180 degrees out of phase. The Pi Network, when you really study it, it's like a seesaw. If the input end is positive, at this instant, the output end is negative. It's a half-wave resonator per se, and it acts like a seesaw. Well, in this case, you only need is a series capacitor. We don't have that effect. So there's only the 33 degrees of phase lag or lead in this case. So we've got some of the answer, John. A little bit more of it's going to be required. I know what the answer has got to be. Mathematically, at the output end of the antenna tuner and the bucking voltage created by the 50-watt transmitter hasn't come out nice, simple mathematics in my mind yet, but I think it will. And you've asked a very provocative question, John. WA2VDH, look at the problem you created. K2IW in the TechNet. A lot of midnight oil has been burned on this one, John.
Okay, fine, this is Vic. The thing I noticed about this, as you say, that capacitor, that minus J150, at the end of that, say, a half wave of line, since that half wave or so is once around the Smith chart, we see that 50 plus J150 there, so it tunes out the plus J150. If at that point you just do voltage division and get the voltage across the 50 plus J150 that's presented at the input of that half wave of line, that voltage that you get there is a total voltage. You can then resolve that into a forward voltage and a reflected voltage and then get the power associated with that. So let me drop. And once you have those forward and reflected voltages, you then get the forward and reflected power. My point is that it looks like there's this round trip of power being reflected and then being re-reflected, added to the transmitter power, going forward, being absorbed by the load, some being reflected, coming back, getting totally re-reflected. But if you look at the fact that looking back on the load side of that capacitor towards the transmitter, we don't have a unity reflection coefficient. It's got to be something less than one. Therefore, the total power can't be totally re-reflected. Let me drop it.
Yeah, I'd be challenging that one, John. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I think what is happening is that because voltages are being added in phase, what the tuner, that capacitor, does is allow for the additional voltages in phase. We have to be very careful how we do superposition with power. When voltages are in quadrature, you know, 90 degrees, then, yes, you can add power directly. You can superpose power. But when voltages are in phase, you can't really superpose power. I mean, a simple case like a 2-volt generator and a 3-volt generator and a 10-ohm resistor where the two generators are in series. If those two generators are in phase, well, let me drop. If those two generators are in phase, 0 degrees between them, and you try to do superposition with power, you'll see that one generator gives 4/10, if it's a 10-ohm resistor, one generator gives 4/10 of a watt, the other gives 9/10, but that doesn't add up to the 2.5 watts that you get when the two generators are in phase. But if they're in quadrature, 90 degrees, then you can superpose the powers. And I think something like that is happening here because these voltages are adding in phase. We have to be very careful. We can superpose the powers. Go ahead.
John, your example of the 3-volt generator and the 2-volt generator, which you can look at from a wattage point of view or a voltage point of view, both points of view will give you the correct answer if you carry out all the details correctly. That's my belief. You can look looked at as the voltage circuit, a power circuit, and once you iron out all the details and don't fall into some of the traps, both methods of approach are going to give you the same answer. Whether you use 7 equivalent or Norton equivalent, so to speak, you're going to get the same answer when they drop. Now, what's unique about this circuit is that your antenna, 50 ohms resistor, 150 ohms reactor, 10.9 standing wave ratio, we know that. When the antenna tuner is properly set, I'm reasonably sure the antenna tuner will be presenting an output impedance. Let me define output impedance. If I remove the transmitter and put a 50 ohm dummy load at the input end of the antenna tuner, and now I take the output terminals of the antenna tuner that's been properly adjusted for this situation, and I look into the output end of the antenna tuner, what will I see? I will see 50 ohms minus J150. I will see exactly a 10.9 to 1 standing wave ratio. Output impedance when I put a 50 ohm termination on the input of the antenna tuner. So the output end of the antenna tuner has got exactly a 10.9 to 1 standing wave ratio. Therefore, by simple mathematics, 31% of whatever power you apply to it is going to flow through and go into that dummy load. 31% is going to flow through, and 69% is going to be reflected. That's if the input end of the antenna tuner was a simple, pure, passive 50 ohm dummy load. But in our particular case, the input end of an antenna tuner got a 50 watt
repeater. Time out.
So even though we know the exact impedances and the standing wave ratios and whatever, and the voltage ratios and reflections and forward flows, that's, we know exactly what would happen at the antenna tuner if it was a 50 ohm dummy load on the input end. The fact that there's an active transmitter there makes a whole new set of rules come about of bucking voltages in phase or out of phase, and I'm reasonably sure there's going to be a 33.7 degree phase shift involved. There's going to be lots of reflection involved. There's got to be bucking voltage, because I know the normal 31% of power that flows through, whether it be the antenna or the network analog or the antenna tuner, the 31% that normally would flow through at the antenna tuner end, that flow through power does not take place. The transmitter sees no reflected power. He sees a pure 50 ohm load. And you and I would be twisting the controls on the antenna tuner until the bird watt meter on the input end said that. We would see 50 watts flowing forward and 0 watts flowing back when we're finished adjusting that antenna tuner. But exactly what goes on to create that condition where no power flows through in the reverse direction, I haven't ironed out those details yet. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Okay, fine business. Yeah, in the example I had given, though, I guess rather than use a transmitter, I had used a generator of 20 volts, which had an internal impedance of 50 ohms. So, in other words, looking into the load side with that generator, we saw 50 minus J150. Due to the internal impedance of the generator. I was using like a laboratory signal generator rather than a transmitter. I agree if it's a transmitter which may have like a current source looking back into its output or some other strange impedance, yes, the total re-reflection could occur because looking back in you might see a very high, almost unity reflection coefficient. So I think that may be along the lines that would do it. Go ahead.
Yeah, what you said, John, has got some good common sense to it, but there's a problem. You and I know that if I had my real transmitter there, connected to the input end of the antenna tuner, properly set in this case, and I take the output leads of the antenna tuner, look into them and measure impedance, I'd see something pretty crazy because my real transmitter happens to be a constant current generator. But there's a catch. You and I are worried about the fact that the flow-through power going backwards through the antenna tuner is going to try to see the near the open circuit of the transmitter. I say that is not possible. What makes me say that? The fact that you're using a real transmitter there or a real signal generator does not matter. The reason I say that is that when you've got the antenna tuner set just right, let me drop. When the antenna tuner is set just right, your bird watt meter between the transmitter and the antenna tuner input is going to see 50 watts flowing forward, in my example, and 0 watts flowing back. Because there is always 0 watts flowing back into the transmitter, the signal on the transmission line coming back to the antenna tuner cannot see the transmitter. He doesn't know what impedance that transmitter is. Obvious by the fact that the bird watt meter at the input end shows nothing going back, he has no ability to probe the transmitter. You and I can adjust that antenna tuner to get the exact response we want with a real transmitter. We could unplug our crazy constant current generator transmitter, plug in a real, known, good signal generator, nothing would change. The exact same percentage of power would flow through, the exact same impedances would happen. That's my belief. The fact that that bird watt meter on the input end shows nothing reflected means that this circuit can't probe the transmitter. You see what I'm saying on that one, John? WA2VDH, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I agree with you, Dick. Yeah, because once we see 50 ohms there, that line going back to the transmitter has a 1-to-1 SWR. It sees a perfect match, and the transmitter is perfectly happy delivering its full available power. So, yeah, I agree with you. It's an interesting situation. I do think, though, it has something to do with the way you superpose powers when voltages are in phase or out of phase. And I don't want to hold it too much longer with this topic. I'm sure that some others have some questions also. But just as one final thought, just consider two generators, a 2-volt generator and a 3-volt generator that are in series and hooked up to a 10-ohm resistor. If let me drop. And let the two generators be first at 0 degrees, that is, in phase with each other, and then let the two generators be 90 degrees out of phase with each other, and try to superpose the powers. If you let the 2-volt generator operate alone into the 10-ohm resistor, you get 4/10 of a watt. If you let the 3-volt generator operate alone into the 10-ohm resistor, you get 9/10 of a watt. Now, if the two generators are in phase, you get 2.5 watts. You get a total of 5 volts, which is the 10 ohms is 2.5 watts. If they're 90 degrees out of phase, you get a total voltage of the square root of 13, which gives you the 1.3 watts, which is what you get when you add the two individual powers. So when the generators are in quadrature, let me drop. When the generators are in quadrature, you can superpose powers, but when they're in phase, you can't. You have to be very careful with that. Anyway, I think that...
Eric, recognize. That's a nice example you got there, John, with the 3 volts and the 2 volts. But there's one other thing that's got to be considered. As you take the 3 volts and 2 volts signal generators, turning one on and the other off, both on, and you're making the voltages in phase and out of phase, and therefore the voltage coming out goes up and down, the current going into the 10-ohm resistor is always obeying Ohm's law. My 3-volt and my 2-volt signal generator, I can put them together in one great big black box and call it a complicated signal generator. And if I'm always running both of them turned on, in phase I get 5 volts, out of phase I get 1 volt, and as I change the phase between the two, I can get everything between 1 volt and 5 volts. And so, from my output of my big black box is concerned, I've got a 1-volt signal generator which gives me 100 milliamps into the 10-ohm resistor, where I've got a 5-volt signal generator, which gives me half an ampere on the 50 ohm resistor. And if I keep using I squared R, and I know that current, I know how many watts the resistor is dissipating. So there's various ways of looking at it. And whether you add up the powers, quadrature, not quadrature, in phase, out of phase, whether you add up the voltages, no matter which approach you take, as long as you carry all of the details out correctly, at least both of those two approaches are going to give you the right answer, it says here. KE2EJ, KGYW, wait for the beeps, you got it, Eric.
All right, I want to move on to something that I think you might be able to help me with, okay?
Let me look at my list, and you're the next guy on the list. Yes, you came before John S.H.O., so go right ahead. You got it.
Right, let me set this up for you. It's a real problem, a real issue, okay? We're talking about a transmitter, and we're talking about a headset, right? And I'm actually a big believer if it ain't broke, don't fix it, but the power should be decided they wanted to go to. It's a 4CX 3500. Not a big tube, but medium-sized tube. We're talking plate voltage, let me let it drop this. We're talking a plate voltage of about 4300 volts, which means that when things are cool and it's operating with a nice IMAC tube, it runs around 33 mils at about 250 volts. Good current down there, maybe about 27 mils. And it puts out about 1800 watts. Oh, the plate current's about 0.67, so you get the idea of what the IMAC tube is operating at. It's a comfortable 1900 watts, it's been capable of making 3000, but it's well within the parameters of the system. And it's been running like that for the past 2 years. So now, we're going to put in this nice, brand new, very shiny, rebuilt tube. So we put this guy in. Of course, its transconduction capacitance is considerably different, so it's going to require a little bit of tuning to get it resonant again. Let me let it drop.
I'm amazed that the exact same tube would change its parameters from one production run to the next. Eric, go ahead.
I think you're missing a very key point here. This tube that we're trying is a rebuilt tube, rebuilt by some other manufacturer, which probably in its previous life was an IMAC tube. So you got this, the guts of the tube were yanked out and put back together again.
If the old tube and the new tube are both called 4CX3500, you'd like to believe that the sizes of the grids and the spacings, therefore the capacitances and the mu's, should be fairly similar. You'd like to believe. Looks like some kind of change in design did take place, Eric, go ahead.
Well, that was my first sense, because I had to tune it, dip and peak, and until you get to the end, it's considerably a difference in inductance and a different capacity to the tank. Okay, so now we're running around 240 volts instead of like 230 in terms of screen, and the current's a bit higher. And the grid current kind of in the same zone, and we get my 1800 watts. Fine. Tube looks good. Thing's running nice. Right. This is at midnight. 11 o'clock in the morning, the transmitter decides to take a dump. Actually, it takes a dump 3 times. When we finally get there to find it, the green current is like a gazillion almost at the maximum that the tube is rated at if you're running 3 kilowatts. And it's not very happy. So, by the way, in all of this, the amount of drive to the grid stays the same. There it's dropping in. So, after fussing around a little bit, you retune the input coupling to the grid. And we finally get down to a reasonable level. It looks good. good, except I'm putting out 90% power, which is something like 1,600 watts. When I finally try to bring it up to 1,900 watts, everything starts to increase. The plate current increases sort of exponentially. The screen current goes up by almost double. What's going on here?
I'm glad to hear that you did monitor the screen grid voltage. Under certain loading and tuning conditions, a tetro tube can draw really crazy negative currents on the screen grid, and if you don't have a big enough bleeder resistor on the screen grid power supply, the voltage on the screen grid can go sky high, and the tube can start drawing ridiculous amounts of current. Let me drop. By the way, your plate current capability is a function of screen voltage raised to the 3/2 power. So any change in screen grid voltage, particularly an increase in screen voltage, can really make the tube come alive and give you a lot of steam power output. Because the tube has been refurbished, therefore it may have some outgassing going on, is my first guess to Eric. If there's gas in the tube, and the gas decides to become conductive between plate and screen, and it starts pulling the screen more positive, and if there isn't a big enough bleeder resistor, the screen voltage can periodically go crazy. The quickest way, by the way, when you tripped out, is there a way that you can look back at the records and find out, did it trip out because of screen current, grid current, plate current, power output? What do you believe was the tripping phenomenon, Eric? And could this refurbished tube be doing some outgassing where now it doesn't have a perfect vacuum? That's one of my guesses as to what could have changed at midnight. KE2EJ, KQIW in the tech net.
KQIW, KE2EJ, that's interesting. That brings some interesting thought into the whole picture. You gotta remember this is a commercial transmitter, and you set up the parameters so that you don't exceed these maximums. If any of them exceed the maximum, either plate current or grid current or screen current, it's being monitored, and of course what it's gonna do is it's gonna trip it. What it does is it kills the high voltage, waits, 30 seconds, and then pops it back in. It'll do that three times before it shuts the transmitter down. So there's a certain amount of smart, so you don't use your tube. But the fact that it looks like a good tube to maybe let's say 40% of its capacity, and then when we try to go 10% more, it goes a little out of its mind. Gassing sounds like a very interesting thing here. I noticed that now you remind me of that phenomenon that I would get with the IOTs. And don't forget, this thing's got an ion gun in it, so they're prepared for not being a perfect vacuum, and they make it. But the characteristics when the tube's a little gassy is similar.
Yeah, the first thing I got to ask you is that when you exceed one of the set parameters and the tube goes into a standby mode, you kill the B-plus, as you said. The most dangerous thing you can do with a tetro tube is to kill the plate voltage and leave the screen voltage there with the same amount of grid bias and or drive. All of those zillions of electrons that the control grid has accelerated away from those cathodes, they're supposed to see the attraction of that screen grid get accelerated toward that plate, and the plate is much more positive, and they go through the screen and hit the plate. If the plate voltage isn't there, the screen grid is there, the screen voltage is there, all of the current goes to the screen grid, and in milliseconds you can go sky high in screen voltage, and in the case of a 4CX250B, you exceed 33 milliamps at reasonable voltage on the screen, which has got very little thermal time constant. You can burn up that screen in 1 or 2 seconds. This particular tube is a little more rugged, but I hope when you killed the B-plus, you were killing both screen voltage and plate voltage, Eric. And now the next thing to worry about is with the screen voltage not there, if you're still driving the grid, all of a sudden the grid current can go sky high because all those electrons, let me drop. Your grid on the positive half voltages of the RF drive has sucked a huge amount of electrons out of that cathode. They're supposed to fly through the control grid, through the screen grid, and hit the plate. And if plate voltage isn't there, and screen voltage isn't there, and they all get sucked up by the grid, now the grid current's going to go sky high. So I presume drive is killed, screen voltage is killed, and plate voltage is killed when you're in the standby mode. Is that true? And once again, when it did trip, it sure would be nice to know which one of the parameters tripped it. Over to you, Eric, K2IW.
K2IW, K2IW. Don't forget, we're talking about a commercial product here. Yes. Actually, the one thing it's done in sequence is the drive is killed first, and then the screen and the plate killed simultaneously, and actually both brought to ground. So that's the way it works. And the thing that tripped after it's been sitting there for a number of hours was the screen. It's a screen overcurrent.
Is there some possibility that there was a transient in screen grid voltage that didn't get recorded? Maybe screen grid voltage is not one of the things being monitored, only screen grid current. If the tube is leaky, and you now got this plasma drawing current in between screen and plate, sucking your screen grid positive, and when that screen grid goes positive, just another 10, 20, 30 volts, all of a sudden your peak plate current starts going sky high real fast. You can take a tube that you think is normally going to draw half an ampere, and because of high screen voltage, it'll draw 2 amperes and blow every fuse you've got. Over to you, Eric. K2RIW, I've seen that happen.
6DBZ is back for the quickies.
Yeah, now, what you're saying makes sense. Interestingly enough, it's just that 10, 20 volts of increase in screen current, the plate current starts to really creep up on you. The screen count really goes up, which bugs me, because the difference in potential between the two of them is considerable. I really wouldn't expect that to happen. When tubes operate normally, you'll see the relationship between screen count and plate count here. That ratio widens by a huge margin.
Because this tube was rebuilt, and in the process of rebuilding it, they had to take it apart, bring it down to air, and in theory, they vacuumed the thing like crazy, did all kinds of things to make sure that the outgassing is through. However, if they expected the Gettering in there to do all the work of imperfect vacuum, and as the tube is now cranking at high temperature in your transmitter for X number of hours, and that saturating getter starts outgassing, you could get some of the characteristics you've just described, Eric. But the fact that the tube is rebuilt, and you're describing what sounds like gassy conditions, I see a possible correlation there. K2EJ, K2LAW.
Thank you, Eric. That's probably what's really going on. Hal had something he wanted to say. Go ahead, Hal.
Came in on it, but I know screen current is very delicate when you're working with a transmitting tube as far as the loading and everything else. That's the only comment I wanted to make, because I worked with some high power tetros. You really monitor that screen current. Go ahead.
It sure would be nice, Eric, if you had another 4CX3500 you could plug in. A known good tube, go ahead.
Okay, let me just take you back to the beginning of what I described to you. I took out a tube that was 2 years into running and probably had a good 3-4 years of life left out. Runs beautifully. But this is a public radio station, okay, and they're like looking to save and shave every single dollar they could possibly find. There's another engineer there giving them advice, so they decided they wanted to buy a rebuilt tube because it's, X number of $1,000 cheaper. So that's what they did, and they only warranty it for 3 months. So either you stick it in your transmitter and find out whether it's any good or not and you want to keep it, or 2.5 or 3 years or 4 years later and you've got the tube sitting on the shelf and the warranty has long since expired and you put it in and it's got a problem, well, you sure saved a lot of money.
Yeah, the fact that you've plugged this tube in now, inside of the warranty period, you have the ability of handing it back because you can complain that it's acting gassy. And the previous tube, if it was being treated with tender loving care, even though it may be rated for 5 years and you're 2 years into it, I have used the 4CX250Ds that I treated kindly for 10 or 15 years. I mean, the FAA used to trade them out after a certain period of time for fear they would go into wear out. In reality, their trade out procedure was really giving them more infant mortalities than old age failures, if you know what I mean. So it was not necessarily a good thing to do. If the tube is being treated fairly, you get some ridiculous life out of those tubes. And so, I think you've got a reason to complain about that particular tube. And, by the way, let me drop this. Even if you do put the tube in the transmitter for, let's pick a number, 3 days as a trial to make sure it's a good tube, and then you put it on the shelf, and it sits on the shelf for 6 months, almost any one of these tubes sitting on the shelf for 6 months, probably should be put through a wake-up procedure, which I know you know about. I'm telling other people. You apply nothing but filament and air for, let's say, 24 hours in order to wake up the Gettering, because when a tube sits on a shelf for a long period of time, there will be outgassing. The vacuum in there will be less than ideal, and the first time you hit it with B+, if you didn't do a wake-up procedure, you could get an arc over, and every arc over is destructive. So, you've done the right thing to plug it in to make sure it's good, and even if you find it good and you put it on the shelf, I think you're going to you're going to want to put on a wake-up procedure, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Okay, K2RW, K2J, just to start some more useless information at you. The IOTs and the TV transmitters, if you take them out, you've got to light up the ion pump every 3 months, otherwise you're going to wind up with a $27,000 piece of junk. The 4CX3500, like most things do, they don't have a pin. The bottom section of the tube is pure beryllium oxide. Molecularly, the spacing between the molecules is big enough to let the, let a little bit of oxygen pass through it in time. So, and waking up a tube sometimes is a real pain, especially if you've only got one transmitter. That, then you're in trouble, but you need to have that backup transmitter. Yeah, I've done that solo tube because when I first got involved with them, their transmitter was really messed up. And then after fixing it and taking out the tube with an open filament in it, I had a selection of bad tubes until I got a new one. So I was lucky I picked one and ran it for about 20 hours, and then I finally took the voltage into it. It came back to life pretty good. K2RW, K2J.
J2B with a question. Yeah, Joe recognized. Just the filament voltage on and air wakes up the Gettering, allows all of those stray air molecules that are bouncing around from outgassing from all of them, all of the elements in there, allows them to move around fast. The Gettering captures them like flypaper. The vacuum gets better and better, and you don't get an arc over the first time you hit it with B+. WJ2B, K2RIW, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I got two questions, Eric. I'm just curious, why did that radio station decide it was time to change out that tube? And my second question about the ion pumps, what do you usually do to, you have a backup transmitter that you run the tube in, and then, to exercise it every so often, or you have a fixture that fires the tube up? I'm just curious how you fire them. I made myself a little fixture for my 572s. I have a 572, the AM Meritron here. I have a little fixture just with a filament socket and a filament transformer. And my sp- spare tubes, I'll run them on the filament every so often, just, you know, I can fix that for about 24 hours just to activate the getter, and hopefully they don't get too gassy, but the set that I have in here has been pretty good. So just curious about those two points to Eric WJQ.
Okay, the first question I think was, want to repeat it for me, but I just lost it.
And why did they decide to replace that 4CX3500, I think you said?
Well, let's put it this way, there's personal politics involved in it. There's, I'm more or less a consultant, so to speak. There's another cheaper guy that comes and takes care of stuff when I'm not around. So, to that individual's suggestion that they buy their tube, and it's the re-milk tube, which we take one of the duds that we have, which none of them are really duds, they're usable, but send it back for rebuilding. So that's what they did. So now that they've got it, you got to find out whether it works or not.
Yes, is it a Conoco that did the refill?
Again?
Was it Econico that did the refill?
As a matter of fact, yes.
Yeah, I've heard mixed results with them rebuilding tubes. I guess this is another possible negative result. And the other question I had was about the UHF transmitters, the TV transmitters with the tube with the ion pump. I'm just curious how that works. Is there a fixture you have to light that tube up, or you light it up in a back, in an auxiliary transmitter? I was just curious how you did that.
Well, there's a couple of ways of doing it. These things are IOTs, as opposed to Plystron, which is three times as long. Most transmitters, like, I had a 60 kilowatt transmitter, which is two cabinets. So you can light it on one cabinet and light it, if you're changing tube, you want to light the tube up before you actually bring it into service. You can just separate that cabinet and light it up. So you can also, there's also a power supply. The ion pump is built into the tube, so. Actually, when it's 2.5 kilovolts, the thing pretty much cleans up the whole thing in less than 2 days. It hasn't had its filaments on it. You know, these are big, long tubes. They look like, what would I describe it? It looks like a, I guess you could call it 8-inch round pipe or 10-inch round pipe. Maybe this looks like the top of an electron microscope, something like that. But that's the thing, too. It actually sits within a cavity itself. So. There you go.
Cool deal. Cool stuff. Sounds very interesting. If you ever have a tour of the transmitter room over there, let me know. Come by and check it out. It sounds like real cool stuff. So, thanks for your info, WJTV.
Eric, can you run that ion pump on that tube completely separately, just applying a power supply to it? Or is the filament in air supposed to be flowing through the tube when you're using that ion pump? Would you, Eric?
No, you can run the ion pump without the filament being on. When the tube's in service, the ion pump's running continuously anyway. It works.
So the ion pump is collecting any stray air molecules running around inside the tube. Where does the ion pump put those air molecules? Over to you, Eric.
The way it's built, there's an assembly which is in essence just deposits itself on. You know how, like, in a glass tube, you'll see silver against the glass wall, same sort of deal.
The gettering stuff.
Yeah, that's the gettering material, which on a very gassy vacuum tube turns white when it gets saturated with air. So I guess if you had a slow leak in your tube with that ion pump, giant pump that's going to give you a lot of protection for a certain period of time. But when its gathering material saturates, I wonder what indication you get. Does the amount of current on the ion pump suddenly change? Probably not. But I guess the tube will start acting gassy. Has that ever happened to any of the broadcast transmitters you know about, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RAW?
Oh, yeah, you're
going
to love this one. Now, you know, when you're making 30 kilowatts of oil, you're making a lot of heat. You've got to go somewhere. And these tubes are water jackets. And depending upon the quality of the coolant and the care and maintenance of it, really kind of controls the life of the tube, so to speak. When your coolant becomes acid, as it does, as Dalton does, as it degrades, it eats little holes in your tube, and you start to get this molecular transfer of oxygen molecules into the tube cavity. So yeah, there's a point in time where, you know, you can light up the ion pump all you want, and it's going to last, it's just crazy, it's so saturated, it ain't doing anything. And it's time for you to buy a new tube.
I'm going to make a guess that a person doing a perfect job of preventive maintenance is testing the pH level of the coolant to make sure you don't walk into that condition where you're starting to eat holes in the tube. But that takes a very diligent person to be doing that every month or so. Is that true, Eric? K2RAW?
You can't imagine the cuts you can put in your hand trying to take a sample. Actually, not only the pH, but also the specific gravity to give you a sense of what temperature is good to.
I presume the coolant is not distilled water. It's something more exotic, like in the case of military transmitters, they've got a petroleum product called coolinol. And coolinol does a beautiful job, but if it drips on the floor and you walk across that floor with the crepe soles of your shoes, it'll eat your shoes apart. Over to you, Eric.
This stuff is called Dalton 50. Right, Dalton 50. What it is a 50-50 mixture, 50% distilled water, deionized distilled water, and 50% ethylene glycol.
Sounds a little bit like almost antifreeze for an automobile, and I presume that's done so in case you lose heat in the transmitter and you get freezing weather, you don't want to freeze the water around the tube. Is that part of the reason?
Is the boiling point too.
Yeah, well, a heat exchanger is outside, so, you know, if you're in 0-degree weather, you don't want 0-degree water that doesn't move. You'll have a real mess on your hands. Actually, the way I keep it, it's good to about minus 20, so I don't worry about it freezing out. But if you don't keep your eye on it, and specific gravity goes way up on you, you know, you can get to the point where it'll freeze at 20 degrees. So, you know, you got to pay attention to what you're doing. And the last group of people that took care of it didn't take care of it.
What's the mechanism by which the specific gravity or pH of the coolant can change? I assume that that's in a closed system with some kind of a filter. Over to you, Eric.
Actually, there is no filter. It is a closed system. A, they don't consider it needing to be filtered. And B, they need the velocity. They need to be able to move the liquid around fast enough to get rid of all that heat, because it's a lot of heat. Even though the transmitter is water-cooled, it pumps the room up pretty good. Because of the pipes that are leaving and everything else. It's something that you just need to pay attention to.
Are there dissimilar metals inside of the cooling system that can change the specific gravity or pH? And isn't there some kind of a buffering device in there that tries to control both the specific gravity and pH? It sure would be nice if there was a buffer.
engineer, Eric. Go ahead.
Oh, that's all nice talk, but, you know, you're the operator, transmitter, transmitter. I have a license on the air for just like 10 years. The path of the water is actually all the same metal, it's all copper. So we don't have that much of a problem with it. It actually surrounds the anode base, which is just minus 27,000 volts. Actually, it's really a ground. Everything's upside down. But it's pretty efficient as far as taking the heat out, getting it outside, and getting rid of it. And you're the operator, you know, you gotta pay attention. It doesn't change that quickly, but when it starts to change, it's sort of like a curve that, you know, kind of moves along on the bottom, and then all of a sudden it shoots up really fast. So that's why. Get to RWK, JJ.
There are a few of my microwave friends that are using tubes like 2C39s, among others, and they decide to use water cooling because they're pushing the plate dissipation a few times above the manufacturer's recommendation. And so the coolant fluid at the tube end is running at high voltage, and therefore the conductivity of the fluid is something that's very important. Sounds to me like all of your cooling areas are at ground potential, so you don't have that problem. You don't have to worry about the conductivity of the fluid with the high voltage on it. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's why the power supply is at minus 27,000 volts. So anything that is in contact with anything in the outside world is at ground. So it's an interesting way to operate that.
So it sounds to me like the anode is grounded. That needs the most amount of cooling. The cathode is put at minus a zillion volts. And the fluid doesn't cool the cathode circuits. I guess some air gets blown on those. Eric, go ahead.
Well, the tube is in a coaxial format. So, you know, it's into throughout to the outside. The anode being its ground potential. There is a certain amount of air that's blown around it to get rid of some of the heat that's coming from the filament, you know, where the connections are made, stuff like that. So, I mean, it's not like the water cooling is doing everything.
And of course, that air has got to be well filtered, otherwise it eventually piles up with dust, and the amount of cooling degrades. Similar to what we've been hearing about with laptop computers, that periodically you have to clean the dust out, otherwise they start running slow. I hope we haven't put John to sleep, KC2SHO. Still with us, John, KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KC2SHO, I'm still here. This morning, read an article in the Washington Post, a very interesting article, about the 1976 Viking mission, and after reading that article, I was left with a question. We could easily save this to just before the space portion of the net tonight, if you prefer. It might be a good segue. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
I'm so darn interested in that Viking mission. I'd like to hear it right now, John. So wait for the four beeps and tell us the Viking question.
Okay, there's a bit of a lead in here, so make sure I'm not going to overrun the timer. I'll set my stopwatch here. As we know that the 1976 Viking mission, they sent, I guess, Viking 1 and Viking 2. One or both of those carried a lander. After the lander touched down, there was an experiment to be performed. This experiment was called the labeled release experiment. And this test was performed in two parts. The first part, they scooped up some Martian soil and they added a radioactive nutrient to it. And the second part of the test would be the same, except first they heated the soil to, kill any biological material that might be there. if they add the radioactive nutrients and how's the wording that they used, if radioactive gas erupted, well, this means that there is